Welcome to Season 9 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage just over $100 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and individual investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is the founder, CEO, and chairman of Case Group, a leading platform connecting independent financial advisors with leading alternative asset managers. After graduating from St. Mary's in California, this gentleman started his career as a financial consultant at then Shearson Lehman, before striking out on his own, founding several asset management and advisory businesses along the way. In the wake of the global financial crisis, he founded Case, recognizing a need for better access to and education on alternative investments for the independent financial advisor community, and equally, understanding the value and opportunity in opening up that world to investment firms managing alternative businesses. In the last almost 15 years, he's built Case into an incredibly valuable partner to both firms like HPS and the advisor world, and has attracted a blue-chip roster of minority investors, including Apollo, Franklin Templeton, and Motive Partners. He is a thoughtful and dynamic CEO and entrepreneur, and we at HPS greatly value our relationship with both him and his firm. So without any further ado, I'm thrilled to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, Matt Brown, founder and CEO of Case Group. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Colbert, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
All right, Matt, I'd like to start from the beginning. Let's go all the way back. Where are you from originally?
Born in New York, raised in Southern California. My father moved our family out to LA in 1972 from New York. And as my mom describes it, it was basically like we were moving to the moon.
Undergrad at St. Mary's, Matt. Why was that the right fit for you?
My brother went there. I liked their basketball program. Didn't play basketball for them, but I come from a more creative perspective. So was drawn to the liberal arts program there. It was in California and really enjoyed it. It was a great school.
The pipeline from St. Mary's to finance isn't as robust as from other places. How'd we end up in pursuing finance right out of school?
I was graduating from St. Mary's and on the way to film school and took a kind of a flyer interview with Shearson Lehman Brothers. And to be totally honest, I had absolutely no idea who the firm was, what they did, what a financial advisor's role was. Met with a guy who was substantially older than I was in a pinstripe suit, and we spoke for 2 hours. He liked the fact that I could hold the conversation. I remember leaving the interview and saying, gosh, he was a nice guy. I still have no idea what that business really does. Off to film school I go. Next day, the phone rings and he says, would you like to join the Shearson Lehman Brothers financial consultant training program? So I joined and became a financial advisor.
Tell me about that decision. I mean, because you were, as you say, on your way to film school. What was the hook? Why'd you look at that and say, well, actually, maybe this is the right path for me?
You know, the way it was being described, it was a lot about communication. It was a lot about working with people. Those were quite interesting. I actually asked the gentleman, of all the people you could hire that have great finance backgrounds, why would you hire a kid from St. Mary's College that had a, you know, a liberal arts degree? And he said, well, after spending 2 hours with you, I realized that you could talk, you realized that you could communicate, realized that you had the ability to build trust. And those are the core elements of business. And I can teach you the math. And that kind of launched my career.
The human aspects of what we do and the relationship aspects that we do are often the hardest. So I hear you on that. Tell me about that first job. What are you actually doing as a financial consultant for Shearson Lehman?
This was the old days. So this is the 90s. And when you're a financial consultant for a big firm like that, it's a bit of a sink or swim environment there. So I went through the program and then it's about building your book of clients. So that is a lot of phone calls. You're building relationships. You're trying to win business. And it is a definite tough environment. That taught me a lot about being resilient, taught a lot about kind of just being a survivor out there. And I think those skills definitely carried through.
So for then that next step, after 5 years at Shearson Lehman, you strike out on your own, you found Brown Simpson Asset Management. Why was the entrepreneurial path the right one for you?
I was an entrepreneur without knowing it even before college. You know, I started my first company in high school. It was a painting company. Hired a bunch of my friends and we painted houses. And there's kind of a nice feeling about seeing those crisp dollars in your hand when you're a kid. I think, frankly, being a financial advisor in a huge organization was probably the only hybrid that I enjoyed, because even though you are working for quite a large organization like Shearson Lehman Brothers, you're still running your own business within that. And they really encourage that, kind of build a business within a business. Whether it's a painting company or the first financial firm that I launched in the 90s, that ability to innovate, create, hire, and kind of have it all on your own shoulders is just something I've always gravitated towards.
Tell us about that first business you built then. What was Brown Simpson up to?
It was a private equity business. We were investing in small cap public companies and private companies, and it was one heck of a learning experience. It was a really unique time in the market. It was the beginning of the internet boom. And the idea that we had was that a lot of smaller companies needed capital and they couldn't access the public markets, even if they were public. So we were providing private capital, and that was a great business. And, you know, we took that from an idea to almost a $1 billion platform.
You know, I always feel like entrepreneurs will tell you those first couple of years, you mentioned this, the lessons you really take with you. What do you hold with you from that experience? What were the lessons learned from those early days?
That one I can clearly point to. That's when I first really became hyper aware that the people around you are really the key ingredient to your success. I was fortunate to have some good partners. I've also experienced the opposite side of that, not having great partners. And this is kind of a life lesson now that I've been able to put words to, but even as an entrepreneur, you might have the idea, but if you don't have people that you trust around you to embrace your idea as their own and then take it to a new level, even a place that you couldn't take it, you're not going to be successful. You have to have great partners in order to succeed.
I couldn't agree more. As you say, you then moved on to founding Brownstone Advisors. Talk me through the path post your first step with Brown Simpson to then to getting to the case side of things.
I would say that every step in the journey has kind of led to case. You don't realize it. Oftentimes, you know, what you do in life is a collection of your experiences. Working in wealth management taught me everything I needed to know about the wealth side. And that's, of course, where the market I serve on the investor side. Brownstone was the beginning of the platform business. What I was doing there was taking asset management and thinking of it through either kind of more of a fund-to-fund approach or a platform approach. And when I started building that in early 2000, I actually call that the beginning of case. I go back and I read some of the documents and marketing materials that I had created for that business. And I can tell that a lot of the ideas that we're working on today were kind of being...
It was the proto case.
Yeah. It was the proto case. So really, case has been on the drawing board for the better part of 2 decades, and that was a good business. And that's when I realized I had to just take the full jump to building a platform and technology.
All right, so let's talk about this. It's 08, 09, the global financial crisis hits. You land on case as the right next business to build. As you say, this wasn't out of nowhere. This was, you had built to this. But what was the first initial idea? What was like the need in the market that you looked at and said, this needs to be filled?
I knew and had friends at wealth management firms, the largest ones, and their alternative investments were doing fairly well. They were holding up. Obviously, public markets were not holding up as well. And spending so much time in wealth, I was, of course, quite familiar with the independent wealth community, the RIA channel, and then in Europe, the IFA and private banking channel. And I knew their access to alternative investments just wasn't there. So I started to look at how JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, and the big banks had built platforms like the one I was thinking about building, and how successful they were delivering third-party product asset management firms into the wealth channel. And it was a real differentiator for the financial advisor. They got access to great funds. They were able to talk to their clients, win new business, be more competitive. But when you look at the rest of the wealth community, which represents 50% of the assets, the independent wealth community, no one firm was big enough to build their own platform like JP Morgan. And as a result, they didn't have the tools in their toolkit to be able to protect client assets in down markets like the global financial crisis, or they didn't have tools in the toolkit to take advantage of opportunity. And I thought, could I be the universal utility platform? And that was the idea. It was a moment to really see if we could empower the underdog, level the playing field. And we set out with that mission. From day one, we've only worked with financial advisors. We don't go to the C in the B2C. We're B2B to C. And we only work in the independent wealth channel. Really have become a partner for the independent wealth advisor, the RIA, to be competitive.
That makes complete sense. If you're an independent advisor, this gives you access to an education on an alternative asset channel that you wouldn't have had access to. From the other side, firms that alternative asset managers, it opens up an investor universe. How do you gain credibility early on from both sides? Because it makes all the sense in the world. But like, I could imagine those early days, people probably looked at you like you had two heads. How'd you pull it off, Matt?
It was a combination of a few things. First of all, as I tell every entrepreneur, you have to have access to capital. Capital is ultimately what's going to allow you to have the runway to build a business. And I've always cultivated relationships with investors. and was fortunate enough to have great investors, individual investors starting off to back the business. So we had the runway to be able to stay in the game, critical. Number two is that we were able to attract good people with the idea. So with capital and good people and a good idea, I think you're at least in a good spot. Now, that's not going to guarantee a win, but it's going to guarantee that you have time to figure it out. Now, when we started the platform, we were the only ones doing it. We were just kind of creating it as we were going. And, you know, we've crashed a few cars along the way, for sure. But every accident that we got in, we learned, and we learned how to stay on the road. And that's really valuable. The other thing that we had going for us is that I think building a business in a down market's a great idea, because when people are having a harder time, they're often open to new ideas. When things are falling apart, like the global financial crisis, everyone kind of is open. And who was open the most were asset managers looking for new ways to bring in capital. And there's this huge multi-trillion dollar channel over here that's never been accessible to them. We're able to bring that into view.
It makes complete sense, Matt. We're going to talk about some of the reasons for this, but over the last 15 years, the firm has grown impressively. Walk us through the current status of Case. Help us understand the scale of the business today.
The first 5 years, I'll just say, very quiet. And as I would describe it, we were on a surfboard, freezing in the water, hoping for a wave to come, and they just weren't coming. 2015 to 18, we got more and more momentum. And we kind of started playing into that momentum. Firms like Fidelity selected us to be their platform. So some really meaningful wins started to come through. COVID happened. Financial advisors didn't leave their home, nor did asset managers, but transactions still needed to happen. That's a catalyst moment or a major change in behavior that forced people onto our platform. And then, as you can imagine, once people get used to a certain way of doing business, that's easier and better. They don't go back. So 30,000 financial advisors using Case that control close to $4 trillion. That's our channel. On the asset manager side, we have, I would say, about 70 asset managers on the platform, all of which have multiple products on our platform. But the number that I like to watch the most is what we call the shopper to buyer moment, where a financial advisor is on the platform and they are investigating which funds they'd like to buy. They're learning about the different funds, and then they go and they make their first investment. So right now that's at an all-time high. About 3 to 4 times per business day, a new firm is making a allocation to our across our platform or adopting the technology. So we'll bring in 600 to 800 new firms this year alone that will be using the Case technology to allocate to alternative investments.
Okay, Matt, let's talk about capital, because capital is incredibly important as an entrepreneur. You need it in order to be able to build your business. But what do firms bring to the table beyond capital? What was important to you and your investing partners?
A few things. The capital that we received largely was balance sheet capital and not fund capital. We took in some great capital, first from a firm called Eldridge, which is run by a gentleman named Todd Boehly. He's more known for his investing in sports teams like Chelsea, the Dodgers, and the Lakers, but he also has a big portfolio of non-sports companies. A year later is when we did our first institutional round led by Apollo and Motive, Franklin Templeton, Reverence, Hamilton Lane. They're bringing their networks. They're bringing their relationships, credibility to the table. I would say that all the firms that I mentioned that invested in Case brought so much. You know, Reverence is an acquirer of wealth management firms. So his insights into that community are second to none. Motive is a fintech private equity business. They have an arm called Motive Create that does nothing but work with their portfolio companies, technology teams to really help them think through complex problems. So everyone is bringing something slightly different, but it's a lot more than just capital.
Let's talk about the evolution of your business and the growth of it. So as you say, you have had a 15-year run here. There's been certain tailwinds to that that have helped you, right? There's been a massive growth in alternatives during that period of time. Why is that? Why do you think there's been such a tailwind for the alternative space?
First of all, financial advisors, they now have access to alternatives, but they're quite disappointed with this outcome of the 60-40 portfolio. So to add alts and create a modern three-dimensional portfolio of equities, fixed income, and alternatives is just delivering better outcomes for their clients. And they can see that. So they're drawn to that. Firms are also contributing to this narrative, diversifying shareholder base with wealth management assets. And that's newer to the equation. 5-8 years ago, when I'd have conversations with asset management firms, they were very institutionally focused in terms of their capital base. Now, wealth management is a main event. It's a huge pool of capital that's largely untapped, about to allocate to alts for the first time.
Push and pull from both sides. No, that's interesting. Alternatives is a broad term and it encompasses a lot. What are the fastest growing sectors for you on the CAIS platform these days?
It changes every year. We can look at the hedge fund community and then the different strategies there. We can look at private credit. We can look at private equity, real estate. We're seeing a lot of pickup right now in the hedge fund community on the multi-strat side. So the more liquid strategies are also coming back into favor as well. So as a platform, we don't advise, we observe, and it's an interesting point of view, which leads us into the what do you do with that data question.
Matt, what do you do with that data?
Well, data insights is becoming, as a technology business, it's becoming more and more interesting for us. You could see CAIS at some point potentially selling data. You can see us at the very near term being able to bring the value of that data to the users of our platform for an enhanced experience.
And it's interesting, Matt, because you do sit in a really unique seat. The insights are incredibly powerful. And as you say, I mean, I always think about your mission. It's not just access, it's education. Alternatives requires you to educate the RIA community in a different way.
We're getting to the point where the data initiative is robust enough that many doors are opening for how we can use data. But you mentioned access and education. Those are two really important areas. But I will tell you, what's becoming even more important is the management of alternative investments for financial advisors. We call that the trade and post-trade experience. As use of alts increase and more advisors and their end clients have access to and then invest in alternative investments, that's the good part. But the bad part is now they have to manage those, and that's capital calls and that's statements and how do you execute? That's really where technology can also make a huge difference. So as we think about our mission, Colbert, it's not just bringing access, but it's making the experience of buying and owning alternative investments a positive one from what, you know, historically was challenging, operationally challenging.
Well, your post-trade point is exactly right. There is a friction to it and there's a complexity of the operations that's different, and your ability to simplify that for your partners, I think, is incredibly compelling. Let me pivot to the macro for a second, Matt. As you say, you don't advise, you sit as a platform, but you do have insights and data. We're recording this in the late summer of 23. The markets feel better at this exact moment. Recession and inflationary concerns are sort of ever present. What do you think are the most interesting themes in alternative investments in this kind of market?
So we do try to stay neutral, but again, through observation, we have advisors, I don't believe feel that the market is substantially better. I think they're facing a higher interest rate environment, so they're getting rewarded for holding cash in a different way than they ever can remember. The geopolitical landscape is challenging. We have a war going on in Europe. We have, in the US, a very unusual election cycle that we're facing with a lot of volatility there and uncertainty. We're seeing the adoption of alts as a result of all of that. And then within that, you're seeing a tremendous amount of positioning of portfolios to be able to respond to some of those impacts. So, you know, it could be infrastructure as a big theme. It could be, again, private credit as a big theme. You're seeing the market neutral strategies on the liquid side very much improving in terms of their popularity on the platform and interest.
Let me take you outside of work for a second. You know, outside the workplace, you are passionate about entrepreneurship broadly. I want to hear and our listeners get the benefit of what you're doing with Endeavor. It's interesting stuff.
So Endeavor was a journey that I went on from 2000 to 2017. What an unbelievable experience. It started as a small nonprofit organization trying to help entrepreneurs build businesses in emerging market countries. Endeavor as an organization would surround them with know-how, help, mentorship. And oftentimes in countries where it was very difficult to have an infrastructure or a community for entrepreneurship. It has since grown to be the largest entrepreneurship program globally in, I think, over 40 different countries. The amount of employees that these companies have been able to hire as a result of Endeavor, the amount of businesses that have been launched, oftentimes with men and women who maybe didn't have that advantage built in countries like Turkey or South Africa. Endeavor's now since come to America, where it's helping in some of our cities where we need more entrepreneurs to create jobs and create economic change. So it was a big chapter in my life. Case has taken up most of the energy, I would say, in the last 10 years, for sure. But I'm very thankful for that experience that I had there working with those entrepreneurs and working with Endeavor overall.
I love it. Exciting stuff. Matt, great catching up. Exciting stuff already for Case, and I know much more to come in the future. With that, Matt, I want to move to the last segment of the podcast, something we like to call Best Ideas, where we offer up something that's added value in our lives recently. Best ideas, because it's our goal as investors to maximize exposure to those. Matt, as our guest, I'm going to ask you to go first. What is your best idea this week?
So I recently read the book Winning by Tim Grover. He was quite well known as a coach, a mentor to Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, business leaders. And he wrote a book called Winning. And there's a quote that he uses in that book. He says, time for everything equals time for nothing. And what he's saying, of course, is that if you aren't focused and you just are too distracted by too many different things, ultimately, you're not going to do any one thing well. So time for everything equals time for nothing. I actually think about it a lot, making sure that the hours that I spend are either with my family, building my company, and really cutting out any distractions. So I've become very protective of my time. And sometimes that's not easy. You have to turn things down and not say yes a lot. But in order to build a business, you can't just be passionate. You have to be obsessive. And you have to make sure you carve out the time to be able to do it and have that focus.
That's a great recommendation. I'll only add to it his other book, Relentless, I also thought was fantastic. He's a great author. And I agree wholeheartedly with the message from that. It makes complete sense. Listen, I'm going to go a little more lowbrow for my recommendation. But Matt, I do like to be inspired by the guests of the week. As you heard earlier, Matt, from New York, grew up in SoCal, worked in LA. And so I started thinking about one of my favorite TV shows I watched recently, set in Los Angeles. I'll also note, I have three teenage kids. This was a family crowd pleaser. I loved it, but my 14-year-old son, who's hard to convince to watch anything that isn't on Twitch or YouTube, also loved it. So it's got range. My best idea this week is the show Jury Duty, streaming now on Amazon Prime. It's got a remarkable concept to it. They put out a casting call where they told those auditioning that they wanted to do a deep dive on the jury duty process and would follow a case and tape everything, including interviewing the jurors for a documentary about the trial and courtroom process. They find a good candidate, shows up the first day, but unbeknownst to him, every single other person, jurors, the plaintiffs, lawyers, judge, they're all paid actors, and things go off the rails quickly. It's incredibly funny, but it has this remarkable warmth to it, and it features this incredible performance by the actor James Marsden, who is in fact playing himself as if he was on jury duty. It shouldn't work. Like, it's an absurd conceit, but they pull it off, and the final episode is a deeply satisfying unveiling of all they had to do behind the scenes to ensure its success. So, in honor of a SoCal guest, let me recommend the fantastic Jury Duty on Amazon Prime as my best idea this week. All right, Matt, with that, it's time to wrap up for the week. As you said, you're a busy man. We are honored that you came on. It's truly a pleasure to have you. We appreciate you taking the time today.
Colbert, thanks so much. Great being on. We deeply value the relationship with HPS and more great things to come.
Thanks again to our guest, Matt Brown. Check out our show notes to learn more about Matt and his firm, Case. That's C-A-I-S. You'll also find a link to Matt's best idea of the week, the book Winning, The Unforgiving Race to Greatness by Tim Grover and Sherry Lesser-Wenk. And to my best idea, the Amazon Prime Video comedy series, Jury Duty. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.